It's always a pleasure to welcome a friend to the program. Stephen Gottlieb is a WAMC commentator and Albany Law professor. He has a new book out called Unfit for Democracy, where he takes a critical look at the decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Roberts, asserting that the interpretation of constitutional law should be applied with a focus on preserving the system of government put in place by our founding fathers. He joins us this morning to discuss Unfit for Democracy and preview his hour-long conversation tomorrow at Albany Law School with Alan Chartok, beginning at 1 o'clock at the law school's Dean Alexander Moot Courtroom. That sit-down will be aired at a later date here on WAMC and will take place in front of a live audience. It's free. It's open to the public. It's a beautiful space. If you haven't been to the law school, you should go. Professor Gottlieb, Albany Law School's Jay and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Law, is the author of Morality Imposed, The Rehnquist Court, and The State of Liberty in America. He is also an expert on the Supreme Court, constitutional theory, and election campaign law, and it always is a great pleasure to have him before our microphones on the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Joe.
One of the fun things of doing a show like this, and of course working with you for many, many years of having you come in and talking to you, is I think we learned a long time ago that you were working on the idea, and then you're working on the book and working on the book, and then lo and behold, the book comes out, and then we're all very excited, and then we get to read it. And so that's a fascinating and exciting process. At what point did you realize that, because there's two ways of asking this question, and maybe I'll go with the most direct one first, which is, given that this history is not an extremely long history, as opposed to, say, the Rehnquist Court, at what point can you get a sense, as a scholar, of what the Roberts Court is all about, so that you can write a book like this to get a sense of the lasting impact of a court that is still in power?
Well, the Roberts Court has made some major decisions that have yanked the law in very different directions. Some of them, there were sort of antecedents and you worried. Even in the Rehnquist Court book, I worried about what eventually became Holder versus, what's the county, Shelby County.
Yeah.
And wrote about it at that time, and that book came out in 2000, so that's 16 years ago now.
Right.
But there are other things that the Roberts Court's been doing that are much less precedented, or to put it another way, they've ratcheted things up so that this is not just a continuation of the Rehnquist Court, and that's really pretty clear. Remember, this court's been there for 10 years.
Yes.
The Rehnquist had about 20, was it 19 or
just about 20.
Yeah. This is already a lengthy period, but some of the cases that were most troubling happened 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get that, depending upon what the court's trying to do, you can get a sense pretty early.
We'll get into specifics in just a moment. How much of it, when we say the Roberts Court, how much of it comes down to Justice Roberts?
That's one of those impossible questions to answer. Obviously, he needs a 5-member majority.
Right.
And Scalia and Thomas were pretty much on all fours with where this court is going a long time ago. But neither Rehnquist nor O'Connor were prepared to take the court in as radical a direction as Roberts did.
So
then you have Roberts and Alito, who are the two big changes, and they make it possible to go there. It's just that it's the number of votes more than anything.
And you look at how he came to the court of becoming named a justice by George W. Bush, President George W. Bush. And then, very quickly, that nomination turned into a nomination for the Chief Justice. So, and obviously from his background, mm-hmm. you also had a sense of a way that this court would now have its makeup, which mm-hmm. is another way of saying I assumed in some of these decisions you were not overly shocked.
Yes, upset, yes, but shocked, no. That's right.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there were aspects of Robert's background from which you couldn't quite tell where he was going to go. He handled an ACLU case, for example. I don't remember now what it was, but I know that he did. And I knew that he had worked in the Rehnquist, Reagan White House.
Yeah.
But that only tells you so much. There are so many different varieties of conservatism. It's not a single idea. So, no, I didn't know exactly where the court was going to go. And the first few decisions in that first year, I thought they were much more moderate on racial issues than they've turned out to be. Because they actually took the court in the direction of retaliation for making a complaint and so forth that were favorable to minorities.
Unfit for Democracy is the title of the book. So how does that title fit into the story being told in your narrative?
Most of what the court has done has been contrary to what political scientists have been telling us. You can date it in lots of ways, but really since World War II, are likely to destabilize democratic government. That's the problem, that there are many different fields of law where the court is doing things that, based on all kinds of different types of studies, the political scientists are telling us this is dangerous. Now, nobody knows the precise tipping point. These are systems handled by people. But the fact that the court has been doing its share to increase the disparity of wealth in this country, for example, is one of the big issues that they cite. The fact that the court has been stripping the power of some of the protections in the criminal process, protections for innocence, is a rather powerful thing that this court has been doing. Its two decisions on the Second Amendment are very significant, and I think most of the NRA people are thinking of it in terms of self-defense. But some of us think of it in terms of groups like the Klan that have used weapons in systematic ways to destroy groups of people and change voting rights. That is echoed in the way that paramilitaries, and we have paramilitaries, I think, in all 50 states, that is non-governmental paramilitaries, practicing and training and so forth, they have formed major parts in the breakdown of democratic governments in many parts of the world. There are a lot of things that this court has been doing that are really very troubling. I think I start Chapter 9, where I'm beginning to lay out at some length what the court is doing, with a pair of cases where, in effect, they said that prosecutors who deliberately, intentionally, over a period of years, prevented the release of information which would have shown the innocence of the defendants, those prosecutors are not guilty of anything for which they should be sued.
Interestingly enough, many of the notes that I made in the book are in Chapter 9. So let's go Let's go there.
I'm not surprised. The rest of the book is kind of a lead up to that.
So you write about self-government in the Roberts Court, and you say, while Citizens United was percolating through the courts, the Roberts Court compiled a record limiting political rights that exceeds the chutzpah and damage of that infamous decision. You mentioned Tipping Point a few moments ago. Is that not a great example of a tipping point, that decision?
You mean
Citizens United?
I don't think we know the answer on that.
Really?
I think what Citizens United... First of all, the political scientists are telling me that it's not tipping the Republican-Democratic debate so much as it's tipping the debate within the parties. So it's strengthening the Tea Party wing of the Republicans. That's making our politics much more polarized. But obviously, they haven't succeeded in winning a presidential election since the Tea Party became strong. It's not clear that they have a chance of what chance they have of doing that this year. So it's a bit hard to tell in the long run what that is going to do. But yes, I don't think it's a good thing. But there are a variety of things that the court has done which make it difficult to count the votes.
So to your statement that the Roberts Court compiled a record limiting political rights that exceeds the chutzpah and damage of that infamous decision, so there was a lot leading up to this.
Oh, yeah. Aside from the fact that there were some other campaign finance cases, there are a number of cases dealing with the right to vote itself. One of them was the Indiana case in which the two people who wrote the opinions, Judge blanking on his name, Posner, Judge Posner and then Justice Stevens, mm-hmm. have since recanted and said that while at the time they thought that the protections of that in Indiana law was a protection against voter fraud, they have come to realize that that law was simply designed to keep people from voting. One's ability to change and narrow the potential voting population is a very important part of a strategy that ends up sacrificing democracy with its simply breaking down.
The subtitle of the book, The Roberts Court and the Breakdown of American Politics. So listening to your commentaries, you get the idea that this is certainly...
I never listen to those commentaries.
You write them, you deliver them.
Yeah, if I'm in the car, I hear them.
But we really... And this is, of course, the case that is being made by the Democratic Party in this election cycle of how important it is to perhaps change the makeup of the court to, in some way, in your view, stop that breakdown.
Yes.
Is it that simple?
Well... it's hard to know what a future court is going to do with precedent, which are now on the books. But almost all of the crucial cases have been 5-4. So if any member of the conservative majority, and there's no way of knowing who the next justice to resign or die, many justices simply die in office, is going to be. It could be. I mean, a lot of people speculate about Justice Ginsburg.
Yeah.
In a neighboring part of Brooklyn, from where I grew up, and had my cousin as a teacher. my cousin died at the age of 90, not terribly long ago. Many people but as far as I can see. She's probably as healthy as some of the others who are about her age. Scalia and Ginsburg are about the same age. So it's not really possible to know who the next resignation or death is going to be.
If I give you a voucher for the gift shop at the Supreme Court, and you could get, then the voucher was for a T-shirt of any of the current justices, which one would you get? Which one would you redeem?
Probably Sotomayor. Yeah. I love Sotomayor.
Yeah.
She often is the one dissenter, the one person who's willing to call out what's happening. And I saw arguments in the Supreme Court, I think, from her first term. She has always been willing to challenge whatever's there. I think she's wonderful.
I do want to mention, and you have talked in our conversation about in your conversations with political scientists. So it will be very interesting for you to sit down with a political scientist
tomorrow,
Dr. Alan Chartok, tomorrow at the law school at 1 o'clock, in a conversation that will be recorded for our later broadcast, and really have that intersection of the two, of the discussion of the court and the political science that we discuss.
Mm-hmm. The political science, I've actually been following that science, I think, since I was in high school, definitely since I was in college.
Yeah.
Depends what counts of my reading. I read Tocqueville.
It all counts.
I read Tocqueville in high school, and I started reading Lipset in college. And studied with some wonderful political scientists, even though that was never my major. So I've followed that for a very long time, and they've added some precision and clarified what the problem is and how it develops. It's statistical. The Vice President Gore pulled together, I'm sure at Clinton's request, something that was originally called the State Failure Task Force. Mm-hmm. They were trying to figure out what countries would have the regime toppled so that they could be prepared to deal with it. And that created a huge database. And they came up with the conclusion that one of the variable that they used that was the most powerful predictor of the breakdown of democracy was infant mortality.
Hmm.
And there are a lot of ways of interpreting that. It can be interpreted as poverty. It can be interpreted as the government has already failed to take care of its people. But somewhere in there, it's a very suggestive variable.
Stephen Gottlieb's new book is Unfit for Democracy, The Roberts Court and the Breakdown of American Politics. The book is fascinating. It is published by NYU. He will discuss the book tomorrow at Albany Law School with Dr. Alan Chartok, beginning at 1 o'clock at the law school's Dean Alexander Moot Courtroom. That sit-down will be aired at a later date here on WAMC. It'll take place in front of a live audience. It is open to the public, free and open to the public. And again, the name of the book is Unfit for Democracy. Stephen Gottlieb, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much,
and best of luck with the book.
Thank you, Joe. It's always a pleasure to work with you.
Great pleasure. Coming up next, we'll talk to Gregory Crutzen, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.